91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. We all know that our imprints and personal data were exposed online, but to what extent and at what risk? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. To buy something, gain access, or to get a perk, one gives up information valued by not only government agencies, but by a myriad of services and businesses. We'll visit this hour with journalist and Harvard social science fellow Adam Tanner. He's written What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. A mass of interested snoops await to unlock even unimportant secrets. That's next. First, the latest news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Did you have a good weekend, Bonnie?
I did. And you?
Nice weather, yes. Beautiful.
Nice weather.
Well, except for Saturday, it rained. considering Buffalo.
Like well, I know.
Well, this hour we visit with journalist and author Adam Tanner. He's chronicled the rise of analytic data collection, which, of course, has a history that predates the Internet. We know the extent of data mining by the NSA, but are fully aware of big business's efforts to open up our privacy.
Adam Tanner is here to discuss his new book, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. He's also a fellow at Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. Welcome to you, Adam.
Thanks very much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, I was really struck by your introduction. You're telling of your time in 1988 in what was then communist East Germany and the tactics of the Stasi, and you compare it to the internet surveillance that's happening today worldwide, and you even went so far as to use that phrase, the lives of others. Did you see that movie?
Yes.
Okay. So you say that the Stasi would find today's surveillance methods enviable. Are they truly comparable?
Well, first let me tell you the story of the Stasi, and then I'll get to the to the question. So we've just marked the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall this very month. Right. And just a year before that, in 1988, I had a chance to visit and travel throughout East Germany. And on one single day in August of 1988, August 2nd, 10 Stasi agents followed me around as I toured this famous art capital of the eastern half of Germany. And they recorded everything I did over the course of the day in great detail. And so there's a minute-by-minute chronology that says, 10:02, he enters the Semper Opera. At 11:05, he leaves the building. 11:07, he's looking at a map. At 11:10, he's still looking at a map. 11:12, he asks for directions from a passerby, and so on. 10 people are following me around. The question is, what was I doing at the time? Why were the interests of the world's very efficient secret police in the East Bloc following me? And that was, I was writing a travel guidebook, The Frommer's Eastern Europe and Yugoslavia on $25 a day. And it was also an interesting time, by the way, as a footnote, Vladimir Putin, the current Russian president, was stationed there as a young KGB agent at the time. But as far as I know, he was not on my case. So in retrospect, having a 60-page file that was released after the fall of East Germany and the unification of the country shows me what they were able to gather about me on that single day. And so they know a lot kind of minute by minute what I'm doing, but they don't truly understand what I'm all about. Even the concept of writing a travel guidebook is a little unusual to them. And so the interesting thing to me, and the reason why I began the book with that, is that today the information that's gathered about so many of us, hundreds of millions of Americans, can be much more extensive than even the Stasi knew about me at that time. And that's because things such as carrying around a cell phone will have the locational data that it took 10 guys to follow me around and figure out. So you've given up 70% of the information the Stasi was following me around for. And by using electronic devices and gadgets and the internet as we do at every turn of our lives, there's constant information that's being recorded about us. And that's the contrast that I was drawing. And
right.
so it's not that it's used for evil.
No. Yes, I realize you're not talking about sinister. Yeah. You know, I just found it really fascinating that, you know, you said that a sentence, something like, you know, they'd find these, you know, tactics enviable in today's world because of all the access that they do have, you know. But how did you get that dossier, by the way?
So after the reunification of Germany 25 years ago, they made it possible for everyone who had been a victim of the Stasi or who had been surveilled by the Stasi to obtain the file. Ah. So I applied. It took actually 3 years to get it, but eventually I have that. And it's only about that one day. So I don't know if there's other days, if there's more information, but that's what I've been able to obtain.
So you saved it as a souvenir?
Yes. It's in retrospect, it's an amusing souvenir. It has photos of my time there. It has all this kind of information that would have otherwise been long forgotten. But of course, in the digital age, nothing is long forgotten because it's always recorded. And that's what's the enviable part of today's lives, is that information that we do digitally is so easy to record and preserve forever. And that's the big difference from data gathering methods of the past.
Adam Tanner, in your book, you say that if you can get a name, a date of birth, and a zip code, you can get almost all the data of any American.
That's right. This is only because they're unique combinations of people. These are sort of little clues to your identity. So in any one zip code, a person with a particular name will be easily findable. And so the way these kind of things manifest themselves in your daily life that you may not know about is in common transactions. You go to a store, you pay with a credit card, and the clerk says, "May I have your zip code, please?" Now, many people think, oh, they're checking out the credit card for security purposes. Mm-hmm. So they need that information, and I'll have to give them the number. Typically, when it's a person asking you for that number, it's so that they can cross-reference you onto a marketing list because they know your name from the credit card. Once they know the zip code, it's very likely that you're the only person with that name and that zip code. They can cross-reference other information and then put you on the mailing list or the marketing list.
And they can even profile you somewhat racially and religious.
That's right.
By zip code names.
So there are marketers and data brokers who gather this kind of information, and they'll say, oh, he's in this zip code. He's likely to be this kind of consumer. He may be interested in these kinds of things. So part of the problem of the world of data today is that companies are not always open about what they're doing with our data. So the store could have said, may we put you on our mailing list? We have 4 big sales a year, and you might be interested to know about it. Instead, they just ask you for the zip code. I should mention the one exception to that are gas stations. When there's no human there, you do have to give your zip code. That is a security measure. But when there is a store clerk asking you for the information, often it is for this purpose.
Well, before we get to Vegas, which is really a large focus of your book, I just want to talk about what happened. You were coming in the station today, and we had seen it earlier. That's that little piece of torn paper, which had a partial, it's a Social Security. Evidently, it was how we
ended
up there.
An actual card.
An actual Social Security card. You see the first name of somebody. You see the 5 digits of their Social Security number, and you say from that you could find out a lot.
That's right. So this piece of paper that I happened to find and you had seen before in front of the radio station has a first name, first 2 or 3 letters of the surname, and 5 digits of a Social Security number. And for me, this is just sort of a symbol that with little pieces of data, you can often find out a lot of information about somebody. So with this card, I might be able to figure out a lot more about them. But in terms of our daily lives beyond this card, just knowing your pants size, for example, you buy a pair of pants on the internet. If you cross-reference that with what your cable TV package is, do you subscribe to all the sports channels and do you subscribe to all the movie channels and maybe something else, that could indicate that you're a big obese person sitting around on your couch all the time watching television. Does that impact what kind of offers you get on health related things or bank related things?
Well,
what
maybe
about insurance? What about health insurance?
It could be something like that. And so you know, data can be used in very good ways to market to us, to get things that we want and we enjoy. But it could be used in these other ways that insurance-wise, oh, you know, you're a big fat guy, you'll have to pay more, or we're not going to give you this loan because maybe you're not going to last as long as someone who's more fit. And that's some of the issues.
And even the U.S. Post Office is involved. If you do a change of address card, that information is sold to marketers.
That's right. So people don't realize this. Of course, the Post Office wants to deliver mail to people who are actually there. They offer this service to forward the mail. But it costs some money to do that, to forward the mail free of charge. one of the ways they offset that is they sell it to marketers if they have a previous address. So if you lived at one address, you move, you forward the address. Data brokers or marketers that have that information, the old address, will run a periodic sweep of all their names through them, and the post office will sell the update. I just heard from a woman last week who was telling me that her husband died 2 years ago, and she moved since then, and her dead husband continues to receive mail at the new address. Now, she doesn't know exactly how this is happening, but this is quite troubling because every time she receives mail to her dead husband, she's reminded that he's no longer around, which is very unfortunate. And so this is a kind of a small example of how this may work.
We have a driver's license, the last of my late mother's driver's license, and it in Missouri, and it has the Social Security number on the driver's license.
So many...
Today, that would be... Wow.
So there was a time when Social Security numbers were more widely in circulation. They were available on driver's license and other documents. But even driver's license, for example, they often have your home address. In some states, they require that. So just showing them to a store, you've given up. You may be having to give up a lot of personal information. They're not the kind of privacy protections in the United States that some other countries in the world do have.
Which we're going to get to, and we are going to get to Vegas. The name of Adam Tanner's book is What Stays in Vegas. We will get there, but it's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Adam Tanner. We're talking about his book, What Stays in Vegas. And Adam Tanner, tell us a little bit of the story of the Caesar casino empire and how they maintain an ethical data use, but they're very tempted to use what we term third-party information.
So if you think about casinos, especially in a place like Las Vegas where there are many casinos, the problem any one place has is how do you get customers versus the place across the street? The games are all the same. The slot machines are made by the same manufacturers. The tables are the same. Now, of course, some places have singing gondoliers or dancing fountains. They may look different, but at the core, the product is the same. So in the 1990s, the company that is Caesars today was called Harrah's at the time. They began to try to figure out a different way to do marketing. And they hired someone who was very different from the past casino bosses. Now, if you think of the old casino bosses, you might think of people like Bugsy Siegel or Lefty Rosenthal, who was portrayed by Robert De Niro in the movie Casino. And later, he was a resident of South Florida, right, in this area here. By contrast, Gary Loveman, who's the CEO of the company today, he's someone who has a degree from MIT in mathematics, a PhD. He went on to teach at Harvard Business School, and he brought his techniques of lifetime consumer value or value of a customer to the company. And that is, if you come to a store any one time and buy one thing, you're not that valuable a customer. Take a pizzeria. You might go there and buy $1 or $2 slice. But if you come week after week or year after year, over time, you're a very valuable customer. So he wanted to gather data about the customers to figure out who they are, who are the best customers. Let's give the best service to these people. And so that's why data collection became very common in the casinos. And Caesars, under the leadership of Gary Loveman, was one of the pioneering companies to do this in the casino industry.
I want to know how this PhD from MIT and Harvard Business School person gets involved in the world of gambling to begin with. How did that happen?
He is a very different figure from those in Vegas. And in fact, there was some resistance to his coming on board at that time. Harvard Business School professors typically teach 4 days a week and have a fifth day for consulting. And that's often very lucrative for them. So he began to work as a consultant for Harrah's at the time in the 1990s. Eventually, they offered him a full-time job as chief marketing officer. And some of his colleagues thought it was a very poor decision to leave Harvard and go to the world of gambling.
Right.
But he's done well in that business. Caesars has some other big financial problems today that are different from what we're talking about, the gathering of data. But he's become quite a prominent executive in the field.
Now, what sort of data are they aggregating? What do they actually know about their loyal customers that get this loyalty program? And what don't they know?
So they know everything that happens within the walls of the casino, in essence, of what you're doing, if you join the loyalty program. And so here's the interesting difference for me, and that is, in much of what we do, buying things on the internet or a lot of these transactions, we don't have a choice. Data is gathered and it may be sold or distributed without us having a say. In the casino environment, you can either join the loyalty program and get the perks that you might get, such as free food or free rooms and so on, or you can gamble, put your money on the table, gamble anonymously. You have that choice. If you join the program, though, they will know to the penny how much you're gambling in the electronic slot machines. They'll have a very clear amount for the other tables, not as precisely. They'll know how much you spend in the restaurants, how frequently you come to the hotel, if you go to the spa, whether you like 1970s rock music or some other kind of music. Do you go to the comedy shows? Do you like Chinese food worth or something else? They will know in great specificity. And that may say that, for example, you come and you typically spend $212 on an evening in the casino. But on the last visit, you spent $700. And of course, when I say spend, in casino parlance, that means lose. And so that may lead them to act differently, because if I know you've had a very rough loss last time, you're comfortable spending about $200 in a visit, I may come over and say, oh, we have some extra tickets to the show tonight. Here they are. And you think, oh, this is a great place. I'm really having a great time here. But of course, you're down that $700 from the past visit. And so that's the kind of information they use to market to you to keep you a satisfied customer.
Well, we all want recognition, especially if we're spending a lot of money, appreciation. So why don't we enjoy that they know so much about us and can be giving us these perks?
Well, that is good if you volunteered and joined the program. So if you're comfortable with that and you're fine that the company doesn't do anything untoward with the data, then you should join it. Now, in the case of the casinos, they do not share or distribute it outside of the casinos. That data is so valuable to them, they don't want competitors buying it. In a lot of other kinds of things that we do, though, the data is shared in ways that may be unexpected. So simple things like you subscribe to a magazine, they often sell your home address. But there may be things that are much more intimate. So if you buy from AdamandEve.com, which is a chain that sells sex products and videos, if you buy from them, they sell your name, address, contact numbers to other marketers. Now, that may be something you had not expected or desired, and you don't have a choice, really. It's in the fine print, so typically customers may not know about that.
And you can get some very racy emails.
Emails or publications, whatever. Now, maybe you're happy to get those publications, mm-hmm. but the thing is, it would be nice if you had the choice, like, please send me future offers like this.
Do they have statistics on A, how many people opt in and how many people remain anonymous, and B, whether the people who are participants in the loyalty program gamble more or less than those that don't?
So it's hard to know with great precision how many join the loyalty program, because those you don't know who is not joining.
Right.
But it seems like something like 80-85%, some very high number of people in the casinos are opting in to join the loyalty program. That's in the United States. So there are contrasting systems. So, for example, I'm just back from the world's casino capital, which is Macau, has 7 times more revenue in casino gambling than Las Vegas because of a giant influx of Chinese money going in there. There, only about 30% of people join their loyalty programs because there's much greater concern about whether the Chinese government can find out who's gambling, what's going to happen with their personal data. And in fact, there's been a fall off in some of the revenue there this year because people are concerned about a crackdown in corruption in China. So it's interesting how personal data in different contexts work. But here in the United States, most people feel confident that the casinos are a good custodian of the data and they join the program.
If Caesars, you said, is having financial problems now?
So in 2008, there was a leveraged buyout of the company just before the financial crisis hit with full force. And so they have a massive multi-billion dollar debt. And that means that every month they have to service the debt. And that's what's caused some significant financial problems for Caesars.
So what if they decide, well, we have a good source of revenue here?
The problem is if you monetize the data after telling your customers we're not going to do that, you will create a lot of upset people.
Okay.
And so my contention is that on the long term, the companies that are most honest with their data that tell you what they do, they give you good value in exchange, those are going to be the winners. And those people who don't aren't transparent and then trick you with what they do with the data are going to be the big losers.
So overall, will there be more transparency in digital data collection?
Well, this is what I'm advocating, both from a business standpoint and from a consumer standpoint, because I think the companies that are open and transparent about it will win the most business. Now, there are companies that make it pretty confusing to figure out what their policies are. Just as I'm coming into the station today, I've received an email from Facebook, and they said, we've simplified our privacy policy.
It didn't look simpler to me,
that's right.
Did it?
Just the initial email took me several minutes to ponder, and then there was a lot of clicks. I was thinking, this may actually take me 30 minutes or some substantial amount of time to read through and ponder. So it's many of these policies are not exactly simple. What I would suggest is something like a nutrition label style piece of information where there be a few basic details. Do you gather other information beyond the walls of your enterprise about me? Do you share your data or sell my data to other people? And it can be a consumer advantage, to be honest. So here's another small example. If you go to Walmart and you buy contact lenses, so there'll be several pages, and just before you get to the point where it says click here, it'll say, we do not sell your data if you buy contact lenses with us. Now, it's not highly personal, but if you wear contact lenses, it suggests what the quality of your vision is, right? And pieced with other information, it could be an interesting profile. So they make it a selling point. So they're going to calm you down at that point and say, we're not selling the information. I think that's a good approach.
I want to know who these data brokers are. I mean, do they walk among us? And what about Jimmy Page? What is that?
So data brokers do indeed walk among us, and many of them are located in South Florida. There is a company, for example, that is located in South Florida, which sells lists of people by medical ailment. So, for example, as part of my research, I would go to the annual Direct Marketing Association convention, and I would go from table to table and look at their various offerings. And one offering was a list of 1.7 million Americans who suffer from erectile dysfunction. And so I said to them, tell me about this list. It looks very interesting. And like, these men, these men, they volunteer the information to us. And I said, well, that's very interesting.
But then
I'm thinking, it's probably not a single man would volunteer this information, let alone 1.7 million Americans. So I said to them, I have an idea. You're selling the list for $85 per 1,000 names. Can I buy 1,000 names? And I'll send them an email or a mail. And I'll say, men, have you received useful marketing offers related to your reported condition? And did you know that you were on this mailing list? And they said to me, that would be an immoral use of our data.
That's immoral?
That would be an immoral use. So the problem is the people who collect data, the data brokers in particular, are often not transparent about what they're doing with our data and our operations.
So obviously these are men who ordered Viagra.
They could have called a toll-free number to find out some information. They could have clicked a box on some survey. So they may have reported the information, but I think many of them might have been surprised to find that they're on the list. And this company has many other medical ailments. But as your question suggests, there are many people who gather information about us. And so one of the more surprising people that I found was the former Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page. And you go to the site jimmypage.com, which is his he has records and music and tour information. But to go beyond the initial splash page, just go into the site to see it, he requires your full name, your gender, your date of birth,
right,
and other information. Now, I've met Jimmy Page, and I still don't know what exactly it's all about. Now, they say that they don't share the information. On one hand, it could be something. If he recorded 500 names and said, hello, James, it's Jimmy Page, happy birthday, and you got a call from a robocall, but it was maybe that would be something that fans would appreciate, right? But it's not really clear what it's all about, right?
Right.
So, but the point is that if someone as unlikely as Jimmy Page, a wild man of rock and roll of the 1970s, is collecting data about you, there are very few firms and people in commercial business that are not. And that's why I think it's worthy of discussion and examination.
Go over this mugshot business and the Coral Gables woman who was arrested over about a $3 restaurant misunderstanding, and that they make their money by people who've been published getting their names off and their pictures off the internet.
So this is another area where Florida can take pride in being a pioneer.
I don't know about that.
So there was a publication in Florida some years ago which would show mugshots of people who had been recently arrested, and they sold it as a little magazine in gas stations and convenience
stores. The newspapers do it also on their websites.
But this was a publication sold some years ago. So a man called Kyle Prawl, who's based in Austin, Texas, said, hey, this is a good idea. Let me replicate this in Austin. He did it initially as a small magazine. He found it successful. And then he went online. And there's a chapter in the book that describes this journey. Now, he's someone who's quite interesting because he was a son of a judge, a successful person with good education and so on. But he found it conventional business a bit boring. So he opened this site, which was a mugshot site. And the way it works is, or it had worked and it's changed somewhat of recent, he would post millions of mugshots on the internet. And when you looked up the name of these people, then you would find their mugshot. And if you clicked on the mugshot, it would say, oh, if you're this person, you can remove your mugshot for $80, $100.
So if you Googled Joe Jones and he'd had a DUI and had a mugshot, it would show up on the Google.
That's right. Oftentimes that was the case. Now, you asked me about the case of Paula Roy, this South Florida resident. She was meeting a friend one day for lunch, and she ordered the small portion of lentils. When the bill came, they charged her for the large portion of lentils. It was $3.68 more expensive. She said, look, I ordered the small portion. The owner said, but you got the large portion and you're going to pay for the large portion. A dispute ensued, and she left the restaurant, leaving the exact change less the $3.68. When she left the restaurant, the owner called the police. The police came and arrested her on the charge of defrauding innkeeper.
Now, was this in Miami?
Coral Gables, yeah.
So yeah, it was right here in this area.
And they arrested her.
It was an Indian restaurant here in this area,
yes,
and they
yes.
arrested her. Now, perhaps if one, I mean, she is a strong-willed person. She could have said, all right, fine, here's the, you know, she could have maybe, but she didn't want to be bowed over because she was convinced that she was right and had ordered the small portion. She was put into jail for 5 or 6 hours. She was released very quickly. The charges were dropped because it was not a good use of public public safety prosecution and so on. But some years later, when she was looking for a job, a friend called her up and said, hey, have you looked have you Googled your name recently? And she saw that her mugshot had been there from this incident years before. Imagine trying to explain to an employer, yes, it's true, I was involved in an arrest some years ago, but it was over $3.68. The charge was dropped. The problem with the mugshots, of course, is that it doesn't represent convictions, which are only a percentage of the total arrests. So this is an example of someone who could be directly impacted by a site like this.
We're speaking with Adam Tanner. He's a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. He's written What Stays in Vegas. Another break, actually, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Adam Tanner. He's a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science and the author of What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Okay, well, I have a question about this woman with the mugshot so we can follow up here. So what happened? So they said, have you looked at your profile lately?
Okay, so she goes to the site and she sees there. Now, The mugshot companies wanted her to pay, and she didn't want to pay. Now, some of them had an arrangement. So Busted Mugshots, which is the company that I feature in one of the chapters, has an arrangement that if you've been acquitted of the crime, then they will take down the site. So it took her a lot of work, several back and forths with the company and several applications, and eventually she did get her photo removed after she had proved with documentation that she had been acquitted.
If you want to join in the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Maybe you want to know about what's happening to your personal data. Our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
Adam Tanner, this morning I came in after reading your book, and I got online and did some search engines because I wanted to see this Kristen Bright that you talk about. I couldn't find her any more of her videos or pictures, but tell the story of Instant Checkmate about spouse surveillance and Kristen Bright.
So there have been many companies in recent years that have gone into the business of selling personal data. And often it's things such as where do people live, what are their phone numbers, email contacts. Some of them have more extensive service, which might be criminal record checks and things like that, or consumer profiles. So one of the companies that's been quite successful in their marketing is called Instant Checkmate. It's a service that started as a way to find out something about people you were dating, and that's why it's called Instant Checkmate, Check Your Mate. Now, the company was fairly secretive about who they were and how they operated. Now, I mentioned before, a lot of these companies are not particularly open about their background. The only thing that you could publicly tell about the company was they put out a lot of press releases and statements from someone called Kristen Bright. But when I called to their offices and tried to establish contact with her or sent her emails and other things, either she wasn't there or people hadn't seen her or didn't know anything about her. I became suspicious that there was something a bit odd. Maybe this person didn't really exist. I had a single clue to her identity, and that was there was a Yelp page in the name of this company. It had a tiny photograph the size of a thumbnail. And I thought, if I could find something about this woman from a thumbnail, it would show how vulnerable anyone could be with a tiny bit of data. How much could you find out? And again, we talked a little before about a fragment of a Social Security card. Can I find out a lot of detail about this woman from this Social Security card? The same was the effort in this chapter of the book, from this tiny thumbnail photo. Basically, to make a long story short, going back and forth through various data banks, that photo helped me identify some other photos. It helped me find some clues about this woman's identity. Some of the photos showing her were very innocent photos of her with her family, but there were other saucy photos, some of them in bikinis, some of them topless, but kind of homemade shots. And I eventually, through a lot of sleuthing work, I was able to find her and her husband. Her real name is Anne. The husband's name is Tom. And I called up and I wanted to, my main question was, do you actually work for this company? Are you the person behind that photo? And did you know about it? And so I call up Tom and I say, Tom, here's who I am. Here's what I'm doing. And he's like, in the olden days, you used to be able to put up pictures on the internet with complete anonymity. But nowadays you do it and you get some guy from Harvard calling you up on a cell phone. And basically what this couple had done is they had posted photos in 2003 or something before the era of Facebook, and they became popular and attracted a crowd, and eventually they started putting in saucy photos of themselves. I've told you sort of the PG version of that story, and if you want to hear the longer, saucier story, unfortunately you have to read the book. But it's just an example that you can find out a lot about someone just based on this fragmentary information.
But they had to move. It cost her job and also her marriage.
Well, She worked, firstly, she did not work for this. She was not right. Kristen Bright. She had no idea about this company. And the company later said that someone must have posted this without their knowledge. They denied any knowledge of it. But she worked as a high school secretary. And because there were erotic images involved, when it was found out that she was this woman, people came around to see who she was, and it caused a considerable amount of a stir and embarrassment, and she eventually left that job. Now, subsequently, she's been divorced from her husband. I'm not sure if it's directly related to this incident in their lives, but it was their own flirtation with internet erotica that led to some of the troubles. But yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No,
go ahead. You're left speechless. Yes,
no,
go ahead.
Yes, yes. Does Instant Checkmate still exist?
Yes.
They do. I want to get to some things we can actually do. But one thing, when you were talking about the erectile dysfunction, how do they compile medical information? Aren't there laws protecting people, like the HIPAA laws? Don't those protect people from the gathering of medical information about conditions?
So medical information is very interesting because unknowns to us, our medical data is regularly sold and traded. So you go to a pharmacy, you fill a prescription, that information is sold, but your name is removed. So your data is anonymized, which means it may say you're a woman of this age in this zip code or this partial zip code, and they sell that information, and often that information, your medical history, may be pieced together behind the scenes in an anonymized way and traded. So there's sort of two categories of information. There's that anonymized dossier about you that exists for marketing purposes, and then there's the information that's collected for commercial purposes. Now, if these men, the 1.7 million men, actually clicked a box that said, you know, this survey, I'm willing to put it in, or enter this contest, you know, let us know your medical conditions and enter a sweepstakes for a trip to Europe or whatever, then that information could be sold. The issue, though, is there true consent? Do people really realize that when they're clicking the box that say, I consent, that it may be, data may be sold and shared? The whole issue of medical information and medical privacy is something that I'm still researching now. And in fact, I plan to write a book about it in the future because it's quite complicated, but quite interesting. It's really a multi-billion dollar trade that's behind it.
This is really, we have an emailer, Carlos says, there's a website called, well, I don't really want to say it because he says it lists the names, addresses, and dates of birth of every registered Florida voter.
So this is probably true. Now, a lot of what marketing companies have at the base are public records. And what marketers do will take these things such as voter lists or other information that's in the public. It might be marriage lists or property records. And then they'll build additional information about that for marketing purposes. Now, this voter list poses an interesting question because, in essence, you have to choose between your democratic right to vote or your right to privacy.
Yeah.
Because if you don't want your home address to be published in this way or be available to anyone who looks it up, you have to decline to register the vote.
But date of birth?
I mean, because that information is on there. Now, so part of my goal in writing this book, What Stays in Vegas, is to encourage a debate. If people want to protest and they find this something that they're not comfortable with, bring it up with your legislators or whoever. Let's discuss this issue, right? But it is not a convenient choice to say my full democratic rights to vote, or I have to reveal all this information on and make it available to the public.
No, it's not a good choice. Well, hopefully we'll come back. And do you know Julia Angwin's book? We had her on, the Dragnet Nation. Yeah, we had her on. Okay, we're speaking with Adam Tanner, the author of What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. One more short break.
And we're back, 47 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with Adam Tanner. His book is What Stays in Vegas. Adam Tanner, you said you wanted to elaborate more on public records.
So we've talked a little about the mugshot websites where they use things that are publicly, photos that are publicly available, put them on the internet. They made a business out of them. We've just talked about this site here that lists all Florida voters, and they have contact information, date of birth, and so on. So the question may be, why is this information available so easily? And the answer is that in its genesis, it's all about transparency in government. So you don't want people arrested in the middle of the night with no accountability as to who's been arrested and what's happening. That's why these photos and arrest records are available. You want to know that people are fairly being allowed to vote, and you want to make sure if you're in different parties that it's not being manipulated in some way. So there's very sound logic behind why this was done in the past. What's happening today is you get a sort of clash with this ability to aggregate information and put everything together in one place and then market on it or do different kinds of things on it. And that's some of the dilemma we face now in the internet age.
This is a very commercial site. It, first of all, has Lee County Supervisor of Elections. It has a lot of ads on it. It talks about arrest things if you click on something. And then it says search by name. The alphabetical pages have been improved to include a number of monthly editions of the Florida voter list, so the same person may be listed under different addresses or names. Visit the voters detail page.
So again, you know, this is something that's controlled on a state-to-state basis. So since the mugshots sites have come into public attention in the last year or so, some states have acted to forbid the charging of fees to remove photos after the fact, to kind of cut into that business. if people found it objectionable that it was very easy to find their home addresses and date of birth and so on registered sites like this, this is something that the state could take up and then and make it not a viable business.
How about data that's gleaned from your car? In the book, you mentioned that some insurance companies are now putting bugs in the car so they can tell when you're doing hard braking and acceleration.
Well, so insurance companies, some insurance companies offer discounts if you agree to put monitoring devices in your cars. And they do things such as, what hours of the day are you driving? So someone who drives from, I think it's midnight to 4 in the morning, is more likely to be in risky driving situations than those who are driving in the daylight. If you're hard braking, it may be that you're accelerating fast and maybe you're a riskier driver. So this is something that's a volunteer basis. Now, it could be changed in the future if many people opt into the system. It may be that those who don't opt into the system are going to have to pay the higher rates. Oh. So this is the interesting twist, is that often it's a volunteer basis. The initial people may be the best drivers who join the program, and then those who don't join the program to have their car monitored are going to be penalized. Related to this are the so-called Internet of Things, which is all the devices around us in every day, from our automobiles to our refrigerators, that have data that they're gathering. Should they be allowed to transmit that data to other companies without our consent? There's a lot of interesting questions related to such issues.
Andy wants to know, he says, I'm regularly asked to give the last four digits of my Social Security number. This seems to be a new standard, often along with other info such as birth date, birthplace. As the first three digits of the social are connected to the state you lived in when you applied for the number, can the entire number be surmised, and how do you avoid it?
So some countries that ask, some companies that ask for the last four digits are financial companies. They're one of the few areas where there are some privacy protections in the United States. But there are many commercial transactions where you could say, no, I don't want to give you that information. Of course, in some cases, just having the last four digits of the Social Security number could be the clue that lets you figure out other parts of the information. So the military used to have the reverse. I think they used the first digits of the, they released the first digits of the phone number, of the Social Security number. So if you knew then the last four digits, you might be able to piece together that stuff. So that's, you may not be able to opt out of that for financial transactions, but you're protected there. But for other people, you might just give them a different number that you've made up, right? Or even in the zip code transaction, when they ask you, what is your zip code, please? And you're checking out, and it's not for security purposes, you can make up any zip code you want, right? In this case, he could initially say, my zip code is this, as he signs up for the service, or my Social Security number is this, and they won't be any wiser.
So let's talk about, you have a whole appendix of things we can do to protect ourselves. And I'm just wondering if our love of convenience is what, because Julia Angwin was talking about DuckDuckGo instead of Google, which I know some people are using, but it's not as convenient and it doesn't track you and it doesn't remember anything. So talk about some of the things we can do that maybe aren't so inconvenient.
It's true that to preserve your privacy, it does require often more work or more sacrifice. Now, DuckDuckGo is one way to use the internet in searches without having those searches tracked. There are services that use Google as the basis of the searching and do it anonymously. There's something called Disconnect Me, and you can search on Google via that site. So that's one option. Or it may be that you typically use Google, but if you're looking up something sensitive, then you go to one of the privacy-sensitive things. Other things that you might do might be for cloud storage. When you save documents online, maybe you want to encrypt them, especially if they're sensitive information, if it's medical information, tax information, or photographs. And we've seen a few months back, Jennifer Lawrence and other celebrities saw intimate photos of themselves released to the public because someone was able to penetrate into their systems and bring it out. But there's a lot of these things, like using the encrypted email or storage, is more work and a bit more effort and may cost more because you have to buy some of these services.
So does cloud computing have inherently more dangers?
In essence, yes. I mean, millions use it very successfully and securely, but we've seen even recently, this fall was announced that JP Morgan Chase, the largest U.S. bank, they lost data on 76 million households, which is the address, phone number, email, the contact stuff, not financial data. So you have to think that if even the biggest bank in the country loses data on two-thirds of households, there is vulnerability.
Not to mention Target, Home Depot, all those breaches that have happened in recent, you know, just recently.
That's right. So it does seem to suggest that there's a good logic to encrypting your data, paying attention to privacy and security measures.
Have you had a negative reaction to your book from was Caesars forthcoming with you?
So at the start of the book, I went to see the CEO of Caesars, Gary Loveman, asked him for the participation in the project, and he agreed to do so. So they were very generous in their time. I think they want to show how the world of data has gone. I've talked to a few people since then, so there's no direct negative reaction that I've received.
All right. Well, there is, as I said, a very, very comprehensive appendix that you have where, you know, of measures we can take, things we can do. And again, they're not as convenient. But I also want to give your website is
whatstaysinvegas.us, and the Twitter handle is
Data Curtain.
Is Data Curtain. but the bottom line I did want to mention is that I don't encourage anyone to do any one specific thing. I think people should decide for themselves what they're right. comfortable with. Some people may want to bathe naked on the beach, and other people may want to be much more secure in what they wear in public. The same with data. You know, you can take all sorts of measures and protect yourself, or you can put a lot of personal information. Just think about it. Think about some of the implications of what you do. That's what I'm trying to encourage.
But if you're getting freebies on the internet, chances are you're giving away personal information.
That's right. So some of the things we use most often for freebies might be Facebook, Google. Those services use that information very cleverly to target advertising to you. They don't sell it to other companies. They target the advertising. Other companies use it to sell to other services. So this is something you should think about when you're doing business on the internet or doing things more broadly in the internet era.
Are some of these sites, they seemingly are designed so that you will make an inadvertent click and open Pandora's box?
Many sites are not especially forthcoming as to what their privacy policies are, and they make it easy to click here and proceed.
Right. And
that doesn't seem fair. I mean, if it's a 6,000-word privacy policy that even lawyers at Harvard Law School have trouble understanding, that's not transparent. And I think people should rise up and say, we're not going to accept that if that's something that troubles them. And when I've been touring the country, there are a lot of people who are upset by some of those practices. It shouldn't be fair that one mistaken click means you've given away a lot of data.
Well, that Facebook thing, as you mentioned today, I looked at it and I thought, first of all, I don't have the time to read all this, but it was all confusing. You know, I mean, you have to kind of sift through what you're supposed to do to reset your settings and what it means.
And Facebook is interesting that even stuff you don't say on Facebook can lead to inferences about who you are. So just who your friends are could indicate your sexual proclivity or other things. So there's a lot of
movie likes,
likes and things can also indicate sexual proclivity. So there's a lot of intimate stuff that could be discerned from Facebook. So it does make sense to read those policies, especially for something that you use very often. Unfortunately, work is involved. I'm sorry about that, but that's the case.
But as you say, you know, even attorneys probably have a hard time with some of the language. I mean, you read it today. You said it's going to take half hour. Is it straightforward?
I haven't read the full part. I just read the initial email. So, yes, but likewise with nutrition facts, to know what's the right amount of fat or sugars or so, you know, it takes some effort to figure out what you put in your body or what you give away about yourself. But I think that's an effort worth making.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Adam Tanner is a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. He's worked for Reuters News Agency as the Balkans Bureau Chief, as well as the San Francisco Bureau Chief. And he's written What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. The website is whatstaysinvegas.us, and the Twitter handle is @DataCurtain.
And we'll have links on our website and also our Facebook page, Topical Currents.
Yes, where it's not so private. Thanks, Adam.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Derry. Many listeners download free audio archives of past programs at our website, wlrn.org. Also find more information, links, photos, discussion, and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. We promise not to track you. To Tomorrow's program examines the growing despair of the working poor. The Feeding South Florida organization says it's precariously low on foodstuffs as the holidays near. Only 1% of those who get food assistance are unemployed. Also, a United Way report says more than half of Floridians live below federal poverty guidelines. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.